I'd like to welcome you all here today to our lunch. We're starting a little bit earlier than usual, about 5 minutes earlier, because our speakers today have a whole host of items that they want to share with you. But before we get to that, I'd just like to make some announcements. As always, could you please turn off your phone or put them to silent? That would really help us very much. Some upcoming events that you would like to know about, I'm sure, is tomorrow we have Barry Chung of the Hong Kong Mercantile Exchange, and he will be talking about commodities, China, and Hong Kong. What does it mean for Hong Kong? On Thursday, we will have Sophie Richardson, who is the Human Rights Watch Asia Director, based in New York, and she's coming to talk about China's black jails. Both of these talks seem to be very, very interesting, and I would definitely encourage you to sign up if you haven't done so already. Coming to today's speakers, I'd like to introduce Doug Woodring and Karen Malmstrom. Doug is an environmental and technology entrepreneur, which actually I don't really know what that means, but it sounds quite a mouthful. But he's also co-founder of Project Kaisei, which is, of course, the NGO that's behind the expedition about which we're going to learn more in the next half an hour. Karen, I don't think I need to introduce to many of you here. She's a longtime member of the FCC, former vice president of the club, second vice president of the club, excuse me. And she's enjoyed a wide range of careers during her time in Asia, from photojournalist to communications and government affairs expert. She's also an avid adventurer, and I think those of you that know her would not be surprised that she was very keen to sign up for this project as a volunteer. As for the topic, I think you're all aware of basically the outline of the project. Last August, Project Kaisei sent two research vessels into the Pacific Ocean in order to study the plastic debris that had converged there, but also to explore ways to remove it. It lasted for 21 days, and since the project leaders got back to shore, there's been huge coverage of the whole expedition, both here in Hong Kong and in international media. And I understand that Doug is busy on the speaking route these days, talking to various groups, small groups, schools, etc., about the project. And today is probably the first time he's going to address such a large audience. And I know you're all very keen to find out exactly what he and Karen have to say. So without any further ado, I'd like you to join me in welcoming our speakers today. Thank you.
National Geographic says that we use 85 million plastic bottles every day, every 3 minutes, actually. When you do the back math on that, on the world's population, that is only 2.5 bottles per person per day. Unfortunately, we're using permanent materials for 50% of all the plastic that's made is being used for disposable products, and that permanent material will last 1,000 years, maybe more. 260 million tons of plastic are produced per year. Next year they expect it to be 300 million tons, and only about 10% of that gets recycled. So there's actually a big opportunity here. 90% of that is not used, not recycled, and it's a petroleum product. It means it's storing energy. It's estimated in the ocean that 11 billion pounds of plastic goes into the ocean every year. And that's what we're here to talk about. Project Kaisei was born in Hong Kong and San Francisco. I started this here only a year ago. We really got this going only about 8 months ago, and it was in the midst of the biggest financial crisis on the planet. But we still made it. And I think there's a lot to be said for what we're doing and what this cause is about. In a way, it's like going to the moon. We're trying to get people to the moon in a non-conventional way of bringing environment, innovation, technology, and business, education, policymakers, science all together to do this. And I'm proud to be here in Hong Kong talking to all of you, because I think this is a great thing for Hong Kong and Asia to be leading. I believe it's the biggest environmental project that's ever been launched in Asia with a global impact. We took out two boats in the summer. One was the Kaisei, which you just saw. That's a 150-foot tall ship. It means ocean planet in Japanese. And we took out a boat with Scripps Institute of Oceanography, which is the leading ocean institute, one of them in the world, much like NASA is for space. And we went out on two different routes and into what is called the North Pacific Gyre, or some people refer to as the plastic vortex. And this is an area northeast of Hawaii. Some say it's twice the size of Texas. I would guess it's bigger. It took us 4 days to get out there, and there's nothing there. The shipping channels don't go through that area. It's called the doldrums for the sailors because there's no wind. So people simply don't go there. And if you don't go there, you don't know what's there, and you don't know what the problems are. And that's why we wanted to go out and really study and bring science into this whole expedition and explain what's going on. So we went out. This is the New Horizon. This is one of four Scripps research vessels that they have plying the oceans 24/7 all year round. This is 174 feet. We had about 25 people on here, including crew, including Karen. And it had a lot of great technology. It was filled with devices, lifting mechanisms, and so we could do a lot of research on this boat. We were out there for 21 days. The challenge that we're facing is the growing problem of marine debris, and basically that's plastic. The UN says that we dump up to 100 million tons of garbage in the ocean every year. 70% of that roughly sinks. So we're tracking the 30% that floats, and plastic doesn't go away. So what we're finding out there in the ocean could easily be 30 or 40 years old, because that's when the advent of plastic came, right after World War II. So what we're trying to do is understand this, understand how to prevent it, how to clean it up potentially out of the ocean, how to bring remediation, recycling, innovation technologies to land so that we can much better use these products in our daily lives so they don't end up in a river or stream. So the focus that we're looking at here is the North Pacific Gyre. There's five of these in the world. All the big oceans have them. They're a confluence of spinning currents, basically. The North Pacific is the biggest because the population centers of Asia and then North America border the Pacific. No one knows much about any of the others, and that's probably something we'll look at next time. But we're really using this as a focal point to draw attention to what we're doing on the planet, really, with plastics. This is Ozeki Net. I'm just going to show you some of the technology we use. We dropped this 850 meters under the water to do deep trawls. The reason for that is we want to find out what the fish and the marine life deep down is potentially how it's being affected in the gyre. These marine life migrate vertically. So in the nighttime, they swim to the surface up to where the plastic is and potentially consume some of it and go back down. And we're checking to see what kind of fish we caught and if they're getting anything. We've got a photo of Karin here. We had a working boat 24/7. We never stopped moving. Our boat traveled 1,200 miles. The Kaisei did about 2,300 miles. Bongo nets here look like bongos, but we drop these at 50 meters and then bring them up again to catch marine life and potential plastic that might come up along the way. The problem with these is if you catch a piece of plastic, you don't know at what depth you caught it at. So for doing real plastic analysis, it's not that helpful, but it's very good for the marine life that lives 50 meters and up. On board, we had all kinds of research capabilities, water, material, aquatic life, and it was pretty exciting to be on that boat and bring this up out of the water and take it right into the lab and look for something. This was our chief scientist, Miriam Goldstein, from Scripps.
And now I'd like to take you aboard the New Horizon. This little dinghy is at the forefront of what we were doing. This was on a plastic mission collecting garbage. It's a beautiful day in the gyre, but it's more than that. It's what you don't see. This is a net Doug has mentioned the bongo and the ozeki. This is the net that I became most familiar with because I was working on the night shift from 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. for 3 weeks. So for me, this picture is midnight, moonlight, manta madness. And you'd think it's madness because I didn't want to sleep for 3 weeks because it was too exciting. We were making discoveries in every net. Some animals they still have not identified. Well, you have to get geared up. Most of us on the ship, on the decks, wore rubber boots and safety net and safety vests for 3 weeks. And you think, why in the world would I volunteer for this? I believe very, very strongly all of us have a collective responsibility to do something while we can. So I'm suiting up to go out to see what we can find in one of our manta nets. This is what we found on day 5 at 3 a.m. in the morning. It was the first plastic that we encountered on the expedition. And it was the first of every single manta trawl in the entire Pacific that we went through. We saw this plastic, pervasive, right below the surface, insidiously lurking. This was the most disturbing thing to me as a volunteer. No, it is not a huge landmass, but what is below the surface is what we really have to worry about because it was all there the entire time in every single net. It was so pervasive that after this discovery and more as we got into the gyre area, Chief Scientist Miriam said, we better go on full alert, transect grid intensive station. For 27 hours, this is what the grid looked like. Manta toes for 15 minutes, intervals, every hour, including CTT drops, which Doug will introduce after this, ozeki trawls, everything we could do to try to get an idea of what we actually are dealing with out here. I would call it labor intensive. And I would also call it, well, surviving on caffeine and sugary cereal for me, because I had to stay up and run the water samples at 5 a.m. Another concern that we saw absolutely the whole way are what we call fouling communities. Sea, mini sea worlds that have come up in the ocean on pieces of plastic. You see here algae, you see here crabs, barnacles, flying fish eggs. It's its own little world. The worrying thing for us is where is this going to land? Is it going to be an invasive species? Some of these things have survived for years. We saw very, very developed colonies of these things with hundreds of barnacles, hundreds of crabs. They have to have been out there for a very long time. Now, Doug looks very peacefully sitting there watching the view. However, he is multitasking. Now, he is, one, listening for whales. One of the scientists, whaleman Josh, was a whale expert who wired up to whale radio on the ship. And he has his earphones on and he's hooked up to an acoustic array that goes down to some computers and you can see blips and you can hear something if it is within vicinity. I think 500 meters?
100 kilometers.
100 kilometers. Ooh, okay. The second thing, he's sitting there. Science is a living, breathing work in progress. Scientists on this ship invented a new way to monitor visual, measure and monitor visual plastic that we saw on the sea. And this system was so effective that we're going to use it again on subsequent expeditions. So this is what it's all about to be out there on a science vessel. It's full on. People are always thinking ways to solve the problems, to find new ways to find what we are looking for, and that is the depth of the breadth of the plastic, but that will come later. This is the epicenter, I would say, of the research going on. Miriam was holding a meeting, and most of the scientists you will see in this room, the ones that were not sleeping because it was not their shift, but You have Pete with the Ozeki. You know, it gets very personal out there because you know these scientists, each one is doing a very different area of science, but it's all to do with how their various organisms or areas, whether it's phytoplankton or it's zooplankton, interacts with plastic. Jess, it gets a little weird at night, I have to say. We get philosophical and we are reflective. So Jesse mentioned, let's do a online haiku contest with our tiny bandwidth of 4 megabytes. Well, it gets very inspiring when you see sunsets, because I really only saw sunsets, sunrise, moonrise for 3 weeks, when you see something like this on nearly a daily basis. Oh, and it's the only thing I've ever won in my life. Forget the Mark VI. So that was very exciting. And you look at this guy here. This is a giant squid. Why I show this, it's all about the food chain. And the higher you go up on the food chain, the more of this pollutants you ingest. And we're right up there. So we have to be concerned. This is one of the many, many reasons why I wanted to do this. And according to Jesse, in millions of years, giant squid may be the dominant species. So you have to be nice if you eat calamari next time. So, and you can't see it, but there's a hand in the corner. This squid was so large, the hand looks tiny next to the tentacle. But anyway, that's just a snippet of what it was like to be a volunteer on this vessel. I was very, very privileged to be chosen to go on. And now Doug will continue.
So this, thank you, Karin. So this is something Karin talked about. It's a water testing device called a CTD. It's got 24 canisters, each is 10 liters. We drop this 500 meters into the water every 3 to 6 hours. 10 liters of water is not a lot, but it's guaranteed sample at a certain depth because it's triggered by a computer. In one of these samples, we got plastic at 200 meters, and we got another sample at 160 meters. What that suggests is that plastic in the ocean has some kind of depth to it. We have no idea how deep this is going, what is on the bottom. We were literally just scratching the surface, and we were out there just really looking at surface issues, but because we found these things in an extremely random sample deep down in the ocean, it's something now that we're going to start looking at for the future. This is, as Karin mentioned, the mantitroll. It's only a meter wide, about half a meter deep. Between the two vessels, the Kaisei and the New Horizon, we trolled this in regular sampling over 1 month, 3,500 miles, and we got plastic in every single sample. So it was not as if we were out there looking for a tiger or a rhinoceros over 2 weeks in the bush and maybe finding a footprint. We found this every single time. Josh is here. He's our whale expert. And as Karin mentioned, this is his acoustical array. We drop it 300 meters off the back, and we can hear sperm whales up to 100 kilometers. And it was incredible because we put this in. He said, let's go up to the computer, see what's up there. Immediately, we saw these beeps going, and he said, oh my God, there's something out the back. We ran out the top, and here were the dolphins that were there. It was just like a video game coming right off his acoustic device. This was not in the gyre. This was going out to the gyre and the California currents, which are very nutrient-rich and very big in life forms. In the gyre, it's like a desert. 4,000 meters of water, there's not a lot of nutrients, there's no whale. We did see a few whales, but it's not like teeming with life, and there's not a lot at the surface at all to see, except we found a few of these giant squid, which Karin mentioned. This was about 6 feet long, no tentacles, because we think it got eaten by a sperm whale, but we did pull it up, partly eaten by a sperm whale, but we did pull it up and do inspection on that. And this was the beak, bigger than a big parrot beak that was inside. We had a bird watcher on board. Albatross are known for eating plastic, mistakenly, because they think it's some kind of food source. We did see some of these birds land on plastic and debris when we were out in the middle of the ocean, and they started pecking at it and eating something. And as Karin mentioned, the You know, that brings a whole other issue of toxicity and what is that guy eating when he's in a false, eating something off a false environment. We had video crew on both boats so we could document this whole thing and use images, photos, video for public outreach and education. This is a big bucket, basically, of the catch we got in the Ozeki, the 850-meter drop. And we found some pretty neat things. One of the angler fish we saw was one of only 10 in the world that had been caught of this certain species. And these are actually great images for kids. I was speaking at a school on Friday, and the kids just went crazy when they saw this stuff. And this is a really important thing that we need to associate with, is the life that is out there in this ecosystem that no one's been. It doesn't matter, you haven't been there. This stuff is living, and this is what we have to protect, not just for them, but for what's potentially coming into us. A few other images, the googly-eyed squid, and some. We found a whole bunch of these, I can't remember the name, but we had not figured out what species these were. I have to get the name for you. But this is a eel larvae, actually. It's only about 2 centimeters long, but it's something that we found out in the ocean. And then we found the Kaisei. And on our whole trip, we saw no boats, no airplanes. We were really in the middle of nowhere. But one day, we were talking on the Kaisei to the radio every night, and I knew they were about 200 miles away. One day we were about 100 miles away, and it was 3 p.m. We had just been out collecting debris on the Zodiac, and we calculated our course. We said if we turn to each other, we can steam as fast as we can, and we'll meet each other about 20 minutes before sunset. And lo and behold, at 20 minutes, coming over the horizon was the Kaisei, and it was halfway between our trip, and really symbolic for both boats to be able to meet in the middle of the ocean. In terms of social networking, we did some pretty exciting things with new media, and that's important when you're working with an environmental cause, how to get the word out to the public, especially in a place where you cannot see, and no one is hardly ever going to go there. So we had 2 iPhones with a video capability made for us that could geocode videos, 20, 30 second pieces, and load them. I was taking videos from my boat, load them up to the satellite, straight onto this map, and people could watch us almost like a reality TV show for the whole month that we were going out to sea. Excitingly, we were picked by Google as a Google hero.
The ocean's not healthy, we're not healthy.
One of the greatest threats to elephants today.
They'll be able to take photographs, videos that are GPS located, immediately upload to Google Earth, and use this as a way to protect the forest.
The ocean is just really beautiful, it's magic. To be out in the water, to have seals come by you, and fish, and dolphins. It's amazing.
I remember as a kid playing in the ocean and it being blue and clean and clear, but in the recent years I noticed when I go to public beaches there's a lot of garbage.
Now people worry about you're going to catch something maybe from being in the water. You get a cut, you want to bandage it up and maybe not go in the ocean anymore.
There's an area of plastic floating in the middle of the water that's twice the size of Texas.
We had 2 expeditions go out that were followed by Google Earth.
Google Earth is really the ultimate way to visualize ecological problems. You're looking at a globe and you're able to pinpoint a problem on the globe and go directly to it. And that's the way we used it in Project Kaisei, the North Pacific Gyre. It's a part of the ocean that you would never go to. And we were able to give cameras and phones to those people and have them instantly upload that stuff and let the rest of the world know what's going on.
We created a geo-tracker along with Google Earth so that we could track exactly where they were along their trip, and you could see the trajectory of each boat. So we brought the world along with the science we were doing on our expeditions. During the course of over 3,000 miles, we drug nets through the ocean. We never got a net out of the water that did not have plastic in it.
Even though this plastic vortex might be thousands of miles away, it really does affect your life on a daily basis. The fish end up eating the plastic, we end up eating the fish, and it's back in our systems again. We cannot escape our own trash. The ocean's not healthy, we're not healthy. We don't really need to have containers that last for 10,000 years to hold something that we're going to consume in 2 months.
I can't imagine the future of the ocean if we don't do anything. We'll kill it. We have to change.
So we also set up the first, I believe, global mobile phone micropayment capability. This was available in 64 countries where people could donate to our cause on their mobile phone without having to use credit cards. We did not promote this too much because it launched when I was at sea and we had no bandwidth on the boat. But it's still available, and when we work with sponsors or any companies that have a global reach, this is something that they can put out to their members and their constituents that can help raise the awareness. So what we found out there was a lot of big pieces and a lot of little pieces. As Karin mentioned, a lot of the, anything that's bigger than sort of your hand becomes an ecosystem, and probably even smaller than that. But it's got algae, barnacles, clams, crabs, fish eggs, and all of this potentially is floating around the ocean into different spots where it doesn't belong. So they're living on a false environment and carrying themselves into places where, you know, maybe they shouldn't be. Ghost nets are something we found a large, pretty large amount of. These are derelict fishing nets that get dropped off boats, still continue to kill. These are fish that the Kaisei found within the net. We actually did not find a lot of wildlife that was affected by the plastic while we're out in the middle of the ocean because there's no land there. So if anything were to die, it would either have sunk or be eaten and we wouldn't have seen it. It's not like being on a coastline. But here was something that these fish must have been fairly freshly killed because they otherwise would have been eaten by crabs and they wouldn't be in this net. On this net here, we had a parrotfish which was living, and this was his home. And he must have gotten onto these nets near land because these kind of fish live in the reefs. And there's no way that they could swim around in the open ocean in 4,000 meters of water and survive. So he must have joined this net system somewhere outside. And then we found our dog, Lucky. And Lucky was amazing because he was looking right at us, sitting on the top of this ghost net as we went out and we caught the net. Underneath him was about 200 rainbow runners, which are fish about this big, and six giant dorado, and he was sort of protecting all of them. When we got him out, you could see that he was shocked and happy, but he must not have been in the water that long because he only had one barnacle, and that was the tear under his eye to have seen what he saw when he was in the gyre. But this just sort of shows that it's all kinds of debris that's household type stuff that is making its way into this ocean. And the estimates are that 60 to 70% are all from land-based sources. This is a pretty interesting image. It's not photoshopped or anything. It's just a beer crate or a Coke crate in the middle of the water. If you look very closely, there are plastic particles also here. And when you look out in the ocean, you see a beautiful blue water, and it's not till you start looking down and realize that all these little specks are actually pieces of plastic that have been broken down. And what happens is plastic, most of it does not biodegrade, it photodegrades, which means that the sun causes it to be very fragile and breaks apart with the sun and the waves. This just shows you how this stuff can crack and break up. So, you can see it when you come up, but somehow this cracked along the side, and all of these little fragments are what become the much bigger pieces. Lots of debris, nets and plastic, bottles, lots from Asia, but that's actually because the currents go from Japan to North America, and from North America back to Asia. These were jellyfish, falellas, that were found in one sample net. This was one sample net, and you can see the amount of plastic that was around all of these jellyfish. As the plastic gets smaller and smaller, I We've got samples up here that you can see afterwards, but it really is like fish food, and it gets into microparticles. The problem with this is not that it's just an ingestible piece of plastic, but it's toxified. And this only happens when you're in the ocean. Heavy metals, DDTs, persistent organic pollutants, do not like the water. They sit on the surface. When they find something hard to grab onto, especially petroleum-based, they latch onto it. So the density of pollutants on this is potentially 1 million times, and studies have shown this, higher than the water itself. So when a fish eats this, or any little organism, it's getting toxified by those other pollutants. And then it starts working up its food chain, up the food chain, and that's what we're trying to show. Now, we talked a little bit about the small end of the food chain, but this is something here, a very large plastic case that the navies use. They put listening devices in there for submarines. Very thick plastic, and when we got back to shore, we found something on the edge that we had missed when we were on the boat, and we thought it was a barnacle. When we pulled it out and saw the hole, we thought it was a tooth of something, and we did inspection at Scripps, and it turns out that this tooth, which wasn't a shark, it was the bill of a marlin. And the marlin had actually speared this case thinking it was a fish and got his marlin bill caught. So even the top of the food chain is having problems. And the reason we are listening for whales is because we want to know who's out there doing what. And when a whale goes to eat, he's not going to know if it's plankton or small particles that he's eating. Just more photos here on the debris, which almost looks like it's been scattered around the ocean. Again, this is thousands of miles that we're looking at. We did some testing on the Kaisei for different catch methods, so our intention is to be able to go out there and remove some of this, and the small particles obviously is very difficult to take out of the water. But we are trying some passive netting technologies that would minimize marine life loss, as well as be able to catch the small particles. So we designed this one net called the Beach, which is a ramp, allows the water to run up onto the ramp, push the plastic over the edge, but the small animals, microorganisms that have an instinct not to be beached have a chance to swim away before they get caught in the net. So we want to scale this up in our expedition next summer. Different systems that these are strainers for boats. We found these all over the place that go into drains. What happens if it's not a large piece of material? Some of the big resources are plastic resin pellets that get into the water. These are pre-production plastic. Some people call them nurdles. They find their way into rivers and streams when they're distributing these little very small beads. I'm sure you've probably seen them at beaches. But this then gets ingested by the birds and the fish. And here's some examples, not of the nurdles, but of real plastic. These are recent photos from the Kure Islands, northeast of Hawaii. Midway is famous for, unfortunately, these chicks that are albatross chicks get their stomachs filled with these plastic food, which is regurgitated by the mothers. You can see one of them is a cigarette lighter, bottle caps, all kind of things. And these are just birds that have died because they thought they were full. They didn't need to eat anymore, and they died. Our bird watcher thinks that they're also dying because of the toxicity on that material. Where is this coming from? As I said before, a lot of it's from land. It's not from ships that are out there dumping it. This is problems here. This is here in Hong Kong. You know, we have a plastic bag tax, and some of the companies are out there now putting plastic bags all around their products so that you can carry out a six-pack and not have to pay a plastic bag tax of 50 cents. Laziness, another reason. I don't know why we continue to allow newspapers to be put in plastic bags here, or have McDonald's put plastic bags over every single cup that they serve, because cups work on their own and they don't need the plastic. Now the things we're doing with consumerism, and this is all really should be a wake-up call to what we're doing on land. A lot of the water in Hong Kong, studies have shown that when you buy bottled water, 50% almost of that is actually wasted because people just don't drink all of it, or it gets hot, or they forget it. And that means that effectively we're buying bottled water, especially the distilled water, which isn't even good for you, in your health. We're buying all this bottled water just to pollute, effectively. We're saying, I'm going to give you money to put your plastic around the beaches to these water companies. There's many things we could be doing with filters and other things in around the world. So what is happening? We're living beyond our means. We're leaving a planet that is probably not going to be a great place for our kids, and this is what we have to teach. And when we're looking at environmental technologies, one of the big questions everyone asks is, what is the payback? How long does it take to get this thing paid back? Otherwise, my boss won't buy it, and it's not going to work. And the payback is this, is pollution. And this is what we never calculate in our business discussions. And again, this is something we need to change. One of the things we're doing is looking at, there's new range. The plastic industry is actually, and recycling is changing very quickly. Plastic to fuel is a big potential option here. And if we catch stuff from the gyre, what we want to do is turn that to fuel. If it's a diesel fuel, it has a value. And if there's a value, people are going to pick it up. So all of this material on this beach basically could be turned into these machines in some shape or form if it's not going to go to a different recycling channel, and potentially be at least something that people can use, gets it off the planet, and it gives a value to it. Shifting baseline is something you might have heard before, but unfortunately we're growing up in this era where our kids are used to seeing this on the beaches and thinking this is the norm, and it's not the norm. And this is what we have to change. This was in Stanley Dragon Boat a couple years ago, biggest race in Hong Kong and probably the world for dragon boating, and not one thing was done to clean this up during that day. Project Kaisei is unique because we're not just a group trying to raise awareness and be an NGO that just educates. We're really trying to bring science together with expeditions, bringing breakthroughs in what's going on at sea, bring together people who are doing things on land with universities and research institutions, and accelerate change by really collaborating, bringing a group of people together that may never originally talk to each other, but now they can because it's for one big cause, and that cause is the ocean. We've been working with Scripps, as I mentioned. BIR is the biggest recycling organization in the world with 800 members in 80 countries. We've been approved, we were selected by the United Nations as a climate hero leading into Copenhagen, and the California EPA was on our boat and is very, very supportive of what we're doing, obviously for the California coast. We're also now a advisor on the XPRIZE. The XPRIZE is a group that out of LA, they get funding from wealthy individuals, and they put a bounty of $10 or $20 million on a worldwide task or a challenge that's never been met before. And they did it first with the Race to Space, which Richard Branson bought that technology. He'll be taking space tourism up in a couple years. But these guys put out these prizes to try to create innovation. And they're going to be doing two new ones, one on ocean exploration and one on plastic debris, which we're pretty much right at the forefront of. So we've got a lot of PR, and really excited that all of you, you know, were here at the FCC today, because without the PR, people don't know about the problem, and then they don't know how to help, or they don't think about how to innovate. And because of all of this, we put all this together, we can really make a big difference. We've had artists from China already doing art on our project, and that's great because it's getting in a little bit now into Asia, and we want to build this in throughout the Asian community, not just through universities and education, but research and innovation. So the opportunity for working with us, or at least spreading the word, is that we're really creating a whole global movement. It is like going to the moon, because this is a huge challenge, and we've neglected the ocean since, roughly the 60s, when there were exploration missions going 11,000 meters down into the Mariana Trench. The space program came along and everyone said, wow, let's go to space. Sort of forgot that the ocean was out there. And we're trying to bring that back. And there's a lot we can do here, as well as on a global scale in all countries. It's not just about someone who lives on a coastline. So our main goals really are the cleanup, how to deal with the ocean itself and the gyre, but how to do things on land. And that's where there's big opportunities. Recycling, remediation, different ways to use things, different ways companies can be bringing in different products that are going to be ocean friendly and Kaisei friendly. So Thank you very much for your time today. We'll take some questions.
I'd just like to go to Q&A. If you have to leave by 2 o'clock, feel free to leave. We're running a little bit late. So when you do ask your question, can you please talk over the music? Yeah, exactly, Chris. When you ask your questions, please identify yourself and your affiliation and try to keep it as brief as possible, please. Anybody care to start? Chris, what about you?
I think it's very interesting you make the comparison with the space race. I think of one of the great science fiction writers, Arthur C. Clarke, who started out inventing the telecommunications satellite or predicting the telecommunications satellite, and then spent the next 40 years of his life living in Sri Lanka and dealing with oceanography and deep sea diving and all the rest of that. And I guess I'm also curious that you're going down a couple hundred meters, but the depths of the North Pacific Gyre are much, 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 much deeper than that. You also say that only 30% of the garbage that you're finding floats, specifically plastic. It seems to me like this is just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, to what extent is there, are there plans, or is there the hope to actually look deeper and look further?
It's a great question. We are really looking at what's floating in our mission. I do want to go out without that boat. We could have done bottom samples to 8,000 to 10,000 feet. Takes a long time to do the winch to go all the way down there, and it wasn't part of our float plan. But there are programs around the world now. NOAA in the U.S. has a program to turn ghost nets to energy. One of the other things that we're looking at is ghost nets turning into clothing, and a company in Korea can actually reweave these. So what we're trying to show is that there can be a value on this stuff. And I'm bringing this up because those ghost nets, a lot of them end up on the bottom. So there's different Vancouver and different bay areas that are looking at what to do. But in the middle of the ocean, I think it's, well, almost impossible. You've got extremely cold temperatures, very low metabolism rates. The stuff will get into the silt, and maybe in a million years when archaeologists are looking at us, there's going to be a whole layer of plastic down there at the bottom. But we're not going after that now because that's a little bit too tough.
Hi, Alan Mercer. Look, when I came here, I knew absolutely nothing about this. I kind of got the image from the publicity that you would literally be walking on plastic in the center of this area of the Pacific. I now realize that's not the case. Perhaps you can help me on this. Again, I'm not a scientist, but you're talking about little particles, a lot of little particles and bigger particles, but a lot of little particles of plastic. In terms of, if I put it crudely, what is the amount of plastic per pint of seawater, whatever measure you use, that you were finding in the gyre that you wouldn't find outside the gyre? What is the concentration levels? Can you give me some idea of this? Because, as I say, I rather naively thought we'd be walking across 300 meters of plastic.
Right. No, that's a great question, and that is one of the some of the challenge that we have to face talking about this cause, because people think, oh, it's a big land mass of this garbage, and if it had been that, people would have been out there picking it up a long time ago. The problem is it's so small. Our sample nets in the mantas were 15 minutes at about 1 knot. So we will be doing analysis, we're not done yet, but to figure out how much of this ends up in that space of water over the time, so that we can do a back calculation on the energy content of what it might take if we did a whole cleanup on 1 square kilometer of water, how many grams or kilos of this are there. Our dream was that we could pick up plastic, turn it to fuel, run the boats, and have everything be a closed loop, and I don't believe that's going to be possible. But that doesn't mean that it shouldn't deter us from still trying to get these out of the water, and I think it can be done to some extent. The main issue, though, is that we're using this as the focal point to say to the planet that we have tarnished in our watch, which went under the radar for so long, the biggest ecosystem on the planet and the one that's farthest away, and it's our neglect of use of this material that has now affected something. I mean, we have no idea to know what kind of marine animals or birds or things are being affected like this, not to mention ourselves. So I hope that answers a bit. It's not going to be... We don't know yet. We're not done analyzing.
Well, compared to Aberdeen, for example, or Victoria Harbour, I mean, is this place worse than Victoria Harbour, are you saying, or what?
In some cases, it is. In some cases, you will not find all of this soup in Victoria Harbour because it hasn't had time to degrade, to get photodegraded. You can find it on some of the beaches, but we were out there certainly finding tons of ghost nets and plastic mixed together, but that's, again, it's not your island that you can walk on. So, you know, the fact that we were out in 1,000 miles from any landmass and you could look, there's a bottle, there's a crate, and there's this thing, and there's that thing, you know, it's dense, but it's not something you can just scoop up in one shot. So that's why you need the technology and the marine design to figure out how to get this. And I just don't have the answer yet. We have hundreds of these samples from our manta troll, and we need to calculate how much volume, you know, we're getting of the small bits. The big bits are a bit easier to catch, but you still need to cover a huge amount of water area in order to collect those bigger pieces that haven't broken down yet.
My name is Merle Linda Wolin. I'd like to know how optimistic you are that, one, this can be cleaned up, and two, that you can get to the source, the creators of these plastic bottles, as well as the consuming public, to stop using them. Are you optimistic about both of these goals?
Actually, yes. I think for a few different reasons. I don't think it's impossible to clean up the whole ocean. That's not possible. But we can certainly go out there and make a dent. And in the time that we're doing that, we're inspiring and now raising a huge amount of awareness on material science. And what that material science, basically what we need to do and what we're looking at with the XPRIZE and others is how to turn this plastic into something that is ocean friendly that will biodegrade over 1 year instead of, you know, 1,000 years. So when that person or that company or companies makes this material, which becomes our plastic bottle or our soap container replacement, and that is made from a plant-based material and could biodegrade, then we have at least a huge preventative solution so that you can still continue to use those bottles for Coke and drinking and food and whatever we're using the plastic for. You know, it's everywhere in our life, so it's not possible to just get rid of it. But with the right material science, we can innovate to create something that at least won't continue to make this problem. We're also looking at something with Google Earth we want to do as a global ocean alert system to draw attention to this kind of stuff that comes out of river mouths. If we can propagate the plastic to fuel technology around the world, then fishermen and people who realize this is coming out of rivers after a big flood will realize that this has monetary value. And that will, again, prevent it from getting out there, as opposed to us waiting to have it go in the middle and clean it up later. So there's a lot of things we can do to motivate that cleaning, and it's going to come from all angles, land and sea.
Yes, hello. My name is Graham Ernst. Question. In the beginning, you had an overview map of the Pacific Ocean with a representation of the field. Can you clarify the source of that map?
I'd have to look on there. I don't know where it's from, but there's a lot of oceanographic studies that have been done with floater buoys that have satellite devices and the 7-year float studies that show the tracking of debris or these floats. There's basically thousands of these in the oceans around the world tracking ocean currents, and they map those field. So you're not actually tracking a piece of debris, but you're tracking the satellite route that those buoys took. And that's what Scripps does, and that's what all these other, a lot of science groups are doing. So it came from one of those extrapolations.
We have time for like One or two questions, Francis?
Francis Moriarty, RTHK. Just a couple of quick questions. I'm not trying to look for something positive in all of this, but you mentioned that this area is largely not a heavily nutrition-laden area. But yet when you pull up some of these pieces of plastic, you're finding flying fish eggs and starfish and all sorts of things. And it may be that the heavier pieces sinking down are actually forming reefs. So is there potentially a positive side to this, or is it all negative because these heavier materials are going to degrade eventually and it'll still be? That's my first question.
Yeah, if you talk to Sylvia Earle, who's one of the leading ocean experts, and she's on our board, she'll say that we have to get rid of all of this. You're creating ecosystems that are living in a false environment, and they should not be living on a piece of plastic. You're right that there is a lot of life there, because since there isn't anything else, these little organisms will cling on to whatever they can and make that a shelter. But if it does sink, and we do believe there is, with biofouling, if this had all kinds of barnacles on it, it may well sink way before it would sink if it just broke down on its own with the sun. But that barnacle probably won't survive at 11,000 meters. So the whole ecosystem at the depth is going to be completely different than what it would be on the surface, and anything that caused it to sink, you know, may not survive down there. So I don't know if you're getting the reef effect.
And just my sort of follow-up there is, if we take a really large view of this whole problem, one of the reasons people use plastics is because you actually use less fossil fuels for transport, because they're lighter than moving glass and other substances. That's an incentive. So how do you weigh off any financial gain you have from pulling this stuff out of a river off the money that is saved throughout the entire transport chain of a product by using plastics instead of alternative materials?
I think the angle about pulling this out of a river is not that we're trying to...
I just use that as an example.
Yeah, we're not trying to take over some stream of energy production. We're just trying to say that this could have value. Today, 90% of this never gets touched. It goes to a landfill or burned.
Maybe I confused by the way I phrased the question, but my point is there's a savings in carbon usage by using plastics. That's why people do it. They can move X amount of goods much more cheaply and handle it more cheaply than they would if they used alternative products. So how do you factor
okay,
that in?
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, that's one reason plastic is going to be very hard to get away from. So there's a lot we need to do with policy. Even in Hong Kong, the recycling is not the leading recycling city in the world. If this can get to the right channel and track, I mean, people have talked about a great analysis is the trick with bandwidth and the internet is the final mile, getting someone hooked on to broadband. The biggest trick with recycling is the first mile, and it's getting this plastic into the system that will then be able to be recycled. So if we had the systems in place, then using it is not necessarily such a bad thing, and you can reproduce it, regrind it, turn it into another bottle now, which even wasn't possible a few years ago. And so there's ways to properly use that. The other alternative is to find this plant-based material that at least is biodegradable, but it's still lightweight. So, I just think there's better ways that we can use it instead of simply saying 90% of it we're never going to touch again, even though we made it to make a fork and eat our salad with, you know, for 30 seconds, and then it just sits on the planet for the rest of the time. We need to really refine this whole process of our use.
I think we're running out of time. Maybe one last question here in the front.
Robin Lynam, freelance. You've told us about the objectives and the results of one voyage, but obviously this is an ongoing project. Could you tell us what you're planning to do next and how you're going about raising funds?
Sure. We had raised funds previously from actually around the world. We got some from Asia, the U.S., and Europe, and we need to continue to do that because we spent most of our money on our last expedition. We are planning an expedition for 2010, and we basically plan to be going every summer, but expanding what we're doing. Increase new science and build from what we've learned, but also scale up the technologies for the catching. Even this summer, we want to go with two retrofitted fishing boats that can really bring back big volumes of material. So we can also turn that material into the plastic to fuel process and show that this is all possible. So our mission this summer would be at least probably 60 days, 30 days to Hawaii from the West Coast, change some crew, 30 days back to the U.S. So we're now starting to talk to big corporations for funding, private individuals, foundations, some grants. The problem is this is international waters. No one has the jurisdiction or the liability to really deal with it, and the big institutions, multilateral, have not addressed the issue. And so we're trying to move with a small group that we are and bring all of these people together who can help solve the problem. So we do need help and appreciate anything that you can put out. ProjectKaisei.org is our website, and the Voyage Tracker is there, so students, teachers can watch that. They can see what we did along our trip, and there's a lot of neat information, and we have some great videos. So I'm happy to help anyone. I'm happy to come talk at your companies if you want me to talk to, or Karin and I to talk to employees. I think it's a great cause and something that we can all hopefully rally behind.
That's great, Doug. Thanks very much to Doug and Karin, and thank you for staying a little bit over time today. I'd like to present you with a small token.